All right, if you have your Bibles, please turn to the book of James, James chapter 3, and we finished up last week, James chapter 2, and so this week we are starting James chapter 3, and we've sort of been doing this habit where we kind of just review each week where we've been and kind of where we're headed, and so what are the subject themes of the book of James? There's three of them, and I've said it a bunch. What are they? Trials? Wealth?
Wisdom.
Very good. Trials, wisdom, and wealth. And James is talking about living out your faith, right? And so his sort of overarching theme is living out your faith, and he makes applications in the areas of trials, wisdom, and wealth. And so he started off by presenting these three stabilizing truths. And he's going to kind of refer back to them a little bit today, but he has these three stabilizing truths, right? I can rejoice and triumph in the trials of my life by knowing that God is at work in them. God offers me the wisdom to put the truth to work in my life, and then he's using my trials to make me spiritually wealthy. And so James addresses these stabilizing truths in trials. Then he addresses a right theology of trials, and a right theology of trials is one that recognizes that God is not the source of my trials, but rather he is the source of every good and perfect gift, and so his allowance of trials in my life is a gift that I should be thankful for, right? That I should praise him for. And we don't often thank the Lord for our trials. I don't think that's a regular part of our daily prayers. Lord, thank you that this horrible thing happened to me. But at the same time, once I realize that God is using that horrible thing in my life, I may not thank him for the trial, but I can thank him for the result of the trial, right? And so my trials are something that I should thank him for and praise him for rather than blame him for. And so the conclusion of all of that is that I need to apply wisdom in my life each day by being quick to hear, slow to speak, we'll talk about that a little bit more today, and slow to wrath. And so the conclusion or the result of all of this is the idea of measured and deliberate actions. All right? And we've looked at that the last several weeks, and James carries that idea of measured and deliberate actions throughout the rest of the letter, making specific applications in the areas of trials, wisdom, and wealth, because at the end of the day, faith that works is faith that works, right? We talked about that last week. The last several weeks, we've looked at the idea of measured actions in the area of wealth when it comes to favoritism, when it comes to meeting the needs of those in the assembly. We made specific applications to the law. We reminded ourselves that faith that works is faith that works, right? Our faith is demonstrated by our actions, right? A man may say, thou hast faith and I have works. Show me thy faith without thy works. Can't do that. I show you my faith by my works, right? And so now James is going to take that argument one step further, and he's going to talk about measured actions in the area of wisdom. And he's going to make specific applications to speech, which is yet again an external demonstration of an internal reality, right? And so not only do my works show my faith, but my speech shows my faith, right? And we're going to see a lot of parallels today between where James is now and where he's been. But if you'll recall at the end of chapter 1, what does he say? If any man among you seem to be religious but doesn't bridle his tongue, it says his religion, the expression of what he believes, is vain. And so it's really important within the context of James's letter that we talk about the idea of the tongue and the power of the tongue. And so we're in James chapter 3, and we're not going to get all the way through all 12 of these verses this week. So we'll get through verse 5, and then we'll pick up there next week, and we'll finish. And so we're going to do a two-parter on the power of the tongue, and that just gives me a little bit more time to kind of flesh it out for us and hopefully make it make sense for us. But our outline looks like this. And James starts off by saying, don't rush into being a teacher. And then he's going to immediately follow it up with his first point of support by saying, teachers face a stricter standard. We're in James chapter 3. Join me in verse 1. He says, my brethren, be not many masters. Now, that word masters, the Greek word is didaskalos, and that's the idea of a teacher, right? But you have to remember that this is a Jewish audience, and so the teachers in the synagogues were also among the religious leaders of the day, and so the application here is spiritual leadership and instruction. And James cautions against people flocking to that. Right, the application for our world today would be the idea of pastors and elders and deacons and Sunday school teachers and junior church leaders and that sort of thing. Right, in the culture of James's day, teachers were held in high esteem. And so it's possible that a lot of the people that James is writing to, a lot of the people in James's audience, it's possible that a lot of them were trying to obtain this position as a way to overcome some of the social injustices that they were suffering of the day, right? Because remember, the context of James is that he's writing to a scattered and suffering church, right? The diaspora, right? The dispersion. He talks about that at the very beginning when he says, James, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, right? And so it's entirely possible that one of the problems that this church was struggling with was that they were trying to attain this position as a way to kind of overcome some of the social injustices of the day. And that relates to us as well, because how many of us are like that? Right? How many of us want to be a leader? How many of us want to be in charge? How many of us want to be respected? Right? Everyone wants to instruct others in their ideals, but James says that this is something that should be entered into very seriously, right? You know, how many of us have ever been wronged at work and we just start fantasizing about someday I'm going to be in charge so that way I can tell you what's what? You know, someday I want to get promoted over you so that way I can show you what it feels like, right? I saw a clip, and the video quality was not great, so my guess is it was probably from the 90s. This guy, he's a reporter, right? And so he's the field reporter, and the guy that's in the studio, that's kind of like the anchor, there just seems to be some tension there. Maybe y'all have seen this clip, I don't know. And at one point, the anchor says something. And come to find out, this field reporter used to be like the manager, but then he got demoted to a field reporter. And so now, instead of being this anchor supervisor, this anchor is his supervisor. And I mean, this is live TV, apparently. And there's this banter going on back and forth between them. And it's very awkward, right? But how many of us are like that? How many of us just say, I just want to be in charge, so that way everything can be my way? And so this is something that relates to us. But what's interesting is that not only do all of us on some level desire leadership, but what's interesting is that all of us on some level already have leadership. Right? What is leadership? Leadership is influence. Right? Leadership is leveraging influence to motivate people in a certain direction. Right? And so being a boss and being a leader are not the same thing, right? You don't have to be a leader to be a boss, and you don't have to be a boss to be a leader. In fact, one of my favorite books on leadership, he has a quote in there that he says, and he's kind of, you know, waxing eloquent, as it were, and he says, you know, he that thinketh he leadeth when no man followeth merely taketh a walk, right? And of course, the whole book isn't written in that language. He's just kind of waxing eloquent to kind of, you know, add to the idea there. But he that thinketh he leadeth when no man followeth merely taketh a walk. And so leadership is influence. Leadership is leverage. And all of us have that, right? All of us are leaders or ought to be leaders in some way, right? Leaders in our homes, leaders in our workplaces, leaders in our churches, right? Leaders in our families, right? We all have leadership. And James is saying you need to take that very, very seriously. Well, why? Knowing that ye shall receive the greater condemnation. So he explains why he's making his appeal that we not aspire or attain to these levels of leadership lightly and treat them lightly. He says that we will receive the greater condemnation. And what's interesting is that he uses that word. Sorry, I got a little bit of a cold. He uses that word knowing. Have we seen that word knowing before? Where did we see that word knowing? We saw it in verse 1. He gives an imperative. Count it all joy when ye fall into diverse temptations. Knowing. Here he says, be not many masters. Knowing. And so this is something that we looked at when we were talking about stabilizing truths in trials. And we established the fact that the key to the right attitude when I'm in a trial is knowing something. Right? And what's our phrase? What you know to be true will determine what you do. And so what I know to be true about God in my trials will determine how I respond to my trials. And in the same manner, what I know to be true about those who are spiritual leaders ought to impact the decision to take it on. Not that we should shy away from it, but that we should take it very seriously. And so he says, knowing that we shall receive, right? And so this is a future. This is not a modal. He's not saying you might receive. He's saying you will receive. And he also says what you will receive. He says you will receive, or we will receive, the greater condemnation. Now, this is most likely a reference to the judgment seat of Christ, right? He's already referred to that as well when he talks about in chapter 2 when he was talking about favoritism, right? And he says mercy triumphs over judgment, right? A reference to the judgment seat of Christ. And so this is something that he's referred to already. But the application here is, and so the application here is judgment before God. But we also know that in this life, those who are in leadership often receive an unnecessarily high level of scrutiny. And so what he's saying to the church is you need to take this decision to enter into these positions of leadership. You need to take them very seriously, because not only are you going to give an account before the Lord, but you're also going to have to give an account to the people you're leading. And so as a little bit of a side note, let me say this. I hope you guys realize that being a pastor is very hard. And being an elder is very hard. And being a deacon is very hard. And being a Sunday school teacher is very hard. And there's a lot of things that I could say, but I'm not going to say, because I've only been here a year, and most of you don't trust me enough yet to hear from me without getting defensive. And so let me just say this. Pray for your pastor. All right, your pastor agonizes over you, both emotionally and prayerfully. And so pray for your pastor. I would also ask you or encourage you to listen and consider the perspective of your pastor and your elders and your deacons, right? Because they have a responsibility to God, and their responsibility is you. Right? Paul says in Romans 13, he says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. Now, the immediate application is government, right? And we know that the immediate application there is government, but within the church, there is governance. And with any authority structure and governance, there's hierarchy, right? And so God's hierarchy for the church is that he's at the top, right? And the pastors and the elders are his under-shepherds. And then the deacons operate under the authority of the pastors and elders by assisting them in the daily care of the flock, right? You look at Acts chapter 6, And what did the apostle say? Choose you out among you seven men of honest report that we may appoint to this matter. Right? And so the deacons were selected by the church, but they were appointed by the pastors and elders. And here at Calvary, we've sort of muddled that picture a little bit. We have our deacons also serve as elders, or you could say we have our elders also serve as deacons, whichever way, it's the same. And so, yes, we believe in congregational governance, but elected leaders are placed there by God and recognized by the people. And so a church leader's authority ultimately derives from God and not from the people. That's why he says there is no power but of God, and the powers that be are ordained of God. He says, whoso therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. He says, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. And so because authority is derived from God, those who are dismissive and resistant to hear the opinions of the pastors and elders are ultimately purchasing a heavier weight of judgment from God. And so not only do leaders have responsibility to God, but followers also have responsibility to leaders, right? I mentioned a minute ago that the pastor and elders have a responsibility, and that responsibility is you, right? We see that in Hebrews 13, where he says, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves. Now, we don't have time to really go through that word submit. I think in 2025, our world at large has a very flawed view of what submission means. But in essence, submission means I'm willing to give up something that I'm entitled to so that I can better help you serve the Lord, right? And so submission for a husband and wife doesn't mean, hey, I want Olive Garden and you want Outback. I'm going to submit to you and we're going to Outback. That's not what submission is. Submission might say, hey, I'd love to live around the corner from my mother and have lunch with her every day, but you feel like the Lord has called us to go to such and such a place, and I'm willing to submit. I'm willing to let go of my desire to live around the corner from my mother and have lunch with her every day so that I can better assist you in carrying out what the Lord has called us to as a married couple who's one flesh. That's the picture of submission, right? And we also see that when it says that Jesus submitted to the will of the Father, right? And so he says, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves. Why? Because they watch for your souls as they that must give an account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. And so James is saying, hey, guys, you need to be very careful about this decision to take on leadership, because leadership carries with it a higher level of responsibility both to God and to your followers, but that doesn't dismiss any of us from being good followers to those who are in leadership over us. All right, and so I just wanted to kind of give that caveat there a little bit. And, you know, I heard someone say once, you know, when I stand before the Father, I have to present you to him, so help me out. And that's really what he's saying, right? As pastors and as elders, we have a responsibility to you, and it's something that we ought to take very seriously, but it's something that you ought to take very seriously as well. And our responsibility to present you to the Lord, help us out. And so I say all that to say, I hope you pray for your pastor, right? I hope you pray for your deacon and your elders. You know, we kind of have a sort of a hybrid thing. You know, there's six of us on the leadership team, and myself and Pastor Jim and Terry fall pretty clearly on the side of elders. Terry's our treasurer. We could say he's our finance elder. But then we have three deacons. We have Brandon, Buddy, and Chris, and they also function as elders, and so they're kind of both, right? We're not a single elder rule. We're kind of a hybrid deacon elder thing, and maybe at some point we need to clarify that a little bit more. But now is not the time. But anyways, he says, be not many masters, knowing that ye shall receive the greater condemnation, right? We are called to take the role of a teacher and a leader very seriously because it is a very weighty undertaking that comes with some serious liability, right? God will hold us to a higher expectation, and there is a higher level of condemnation and judgment for us if and when we mess up. And so the first thing that we need to understand about the power of the tongue is that we need to not rush into taking opportunities to use our tongue, right? That's what he's talking about when he talks about being a teacher, right? He says, don't rush into being a teacher. Teachers face a stricter standard, but he also says no one is a perfect teacher. In verse 2, he says, for in many things we offend all. That word for, it's a because, right? It's a support to the argument. But what is he supporting? All right, it could be he's saying, hey, we will receive the greater condemnation because we all mess up. Or he could be saying, hey, be not many masters because we all mess up. But really, either way, it's the same argument. Religious leadership and instruction should not be entered into lightly, because there is a high standard that is very difficult to keep. He says, in many things, we offend all. We could say we all stumble or trip in many ways, right? We all mess up a lot, all right? How many of you have ever noticed a leader mess up? Yeah. Yeah. How many of you have ever been disappointed or let down by someone in leadership over you, right? We mess up. And to be honest, we mess up a lot. And because those who are in leadership face a higher standard, when we mess up, it's worse. And he actually notes that there. So religious leadership and instruction should not be entered into lightly, because there's a high standard and it's very difficult to keep. He says, if any man offend not in word, the same as a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body. He says, if someone never messes up with the things that he says, that guy's perfect. That guy's got it figured out. Well, the problem is, none of us are perfect, right? That word perfect there, it means complete or totally mature, right? That person has arrived. And you know, so often we expect those in leadership to have arrived. But none of us have arrived. And we all mess up. And we all make mistakes, right? He says, the same as a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body. You know, that bridle, that's something that we've already seen once. We saw it at the end of chapter 1 when James says, if any man seems to be religious but doesn't bridle his tongue, he says his religion is vain. You know, a bridle is something that is placed on a horse's head and includes a bit, more on that in a minute, but it includes a bit and it gives the ability to control the horse's movement. Right, the bridle is an instrument of leadership. Right, it gives the rider the ability to leverage influence. Right, and so the bridle is an instrument of leadership. Right, and he says, if a man can control his tongue, then he can control his whole body. But the problem is, we can't. Right, none of us can control our tongue. None of us can control our bodies. I'll give you an illustration, right? I was in a meeting, and we were talking about something, and we were talking about, you know, some direction that we wanted to go, and there was one person who was a little skeptical about the direction that we were discussing. And so as we were discussing different details, this one person kept being skeptical. And I'll be honest, I was getting a little annoyed. And finally, I just said to this person, you know what? It's okay. I have enough faith for both of us. And I released it like a flock of doves. And then as soon as I said it, I was like, ugh, I shouldn't have said that. I should not have said that, but I couldn't take it back. And so I did find that person later on, and I asked that person to forgive me, and that person said they forgive me, and so hopefully that is the case. But our words can disqualify the profession of our faith, and so we need to guard them very carefully. But at the same time, none of us are able to do that perfectly because of the sin nature. So we need to be aware of that, and we need to not enter into our responsibilities lightly. And so the summary here, or the essence of James's argument, is that we should be double careful of taking on the role of leadership, because the damage from poor leadership and instruction can be quite grave. And sooner or later, we're all going to do it. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit, I'm made of the same stuff as everybody else. And I'm willing to admit, I make mistakes. Sometimes I think I do more things wrong than I do right. And I think some of that is just, you know, school of hard knocks. You know, you learn from your mistakes. And in order to learn from your mistakes, you have to make mistakes. But the summary of James's argument here is that we need to be double careful of taking on the role of leadership, because the damage from poor leadership and instruction can be quite grave, and sooner or later, we're all going to do it. And so he says, don't rush into being a teacher because teachers face a stricter standard. Don't rush into being a teacher because no one is a perfect teacher, and the consequences for coming up short can be very destructive. But the third thing that he says, and this is kind of the thrust of his argument, and we're going to pick this up more next week and really drive the issue home with James, but kind of the thrust of his argument behind not rushing into being a teacher, not rushing into being a leader, is that our speech determines our direction. Look at verse 3. He says, behold, or see this, we put bits in the horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. And there's an interesting parallel in that the bit goes in the horse's mouth. And by controlling the mouth, one controls the whole animal. Right? And so he says, you know, we put the bit in the horse's mouth, and by restraining and by controlling the mouth, controlling the tongue, we can control the horse. And you know, I'm not an equestrian. I've ridden a horse a couple of times, but you know, that doesn't make me an equestrian, right? But I've seen the bit, right? I mean, in the bit, I mean, it's like, it's not that big, and it's maybe about as fat as my pinky, maybe my thumb. I mean, it's not a big thing, right? And when you consider the fact that horses are massive, it's really an astounding picture to think that a small piece of metal in the mouth can control the whole trajectory and direction of your life. You know, I had a friend in college came in one day to preacher boy class, and he had a full, like, leg brace on. I mean, from hip to ankle, I mean, the whole thing. And he's, you know, he's hobbling in, and he sits down, and, you know, it's hard to sit down, and his name was Cody, and I'm like, and he's a big guy. He was like 6'8 or something. I mean, he's a big guy. I'm like, Cody, what on earth happened to you? And he said, oh, this past Saturday I was volunteering at the horse ranch. That was one of the ministries that Bob Jones did, and I don't remember what happened, but he said this girl was riding this horse, and I don't know if it bucked her or what, but she fell off of it, and he's standing next to her. I think it was like a little girl or something, and she falls off, and he's standing next to the horse, and the horse starts to back up, and the horse is about to sit on her. And so what does Cody do? He gets down on one knee with her there, and the horse sits on his knee. And so he took the entire weight of a horse, or at least most of the entire weight of a horse, on his knee, and it really injured him. All right, and he was fine, and the girl was fine, and all of that, and I think he got hero points. But the point is, horses are huge. All right, and if it's me versus a horse, in terms of raw power, that horse is going to win every time. But I get a small piece of metal, put it in the horse's mouth, and while the horse may initially be resistant to that, eventually that bit and that bridle and those reins and that saddle is going to break the horse. The horse is going to become submissive. He's going to become obedient. And by controlling that small piece of metal in his mouth, I can control the entire body movement and trajectory of this animal that's far larger than I am. And so the picture there and the parallel about the bit going in the mouth, it's a very apt illustration. But he continues on. He says, "Behold also the ships, which though they be great and are driven of fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm or a very small rudder, whithersoever the governor or the captain listeth." Right? And if you'll recall, this is also something that James referred to in chapter 1 when he talked about not wavering in your faith. Right? He says, the one who wavers is like a ship. He's driven by the wind and tossed, right? He has no control. He's just here and there because his faith is wavering and he has no control over his life. And so his life is just all over the place. And so he carries the illustration forward and says, a ship, even though it may be getting hit hard with the wind, it is still able to navigate even the toughest of crosswinds if it has a rudder. And the rudder is a relatively small part of the ship, but it has very great potential. And so as long as the horse rider has control of the bit, he can control the horse. And as long as the captain maintains control of the rudder, and that applies to both ships and airplanes, as long as the captain maintains control of the rudder, he can control the ship. But if you lose the rudder, then you're at the mercy of the wind and you become like that wavering, double-minded man in chapter 1 who's totally out of control. All right, and so we can tie stabilizing truth number 2 together with this passage and together with the thoughts of chapter 2 when we say that faith comes out in your works, which are testified of in your speech. He says, even so, bringing the illustration home, even so, the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. You know, your tongue, it's like that bit. It's like that rudder. Even though it's a really small thing, it has big potential. And it has big potential to get us in trouble. How many of you would say, I have gotten in trouble with my tongue? Yep, I've gotten in trouble with my tongue. All right, I've gotten in trouble with my tongue this week. I've gotten in trouble with my tongue last week. I've gotten in trouble with my tongue a lot. All right, sometimes I'm like, you know, maybe whoever invented muzzles for dogs was onto something. But we have a muzzle. It's the Word of God. And so the tongue, it's a little bit like a rudder. It's a little bit like the bit in the horse's mouth. Even though it's small, it can do big things, and it can get us in big trouble. And so when it comes to the leadership opportunities that God has given us, we need to take those very seriously, and we need to understand that our leadership is connected not only to our works, but also to our speech. And so if I say I'm going to do something, I need to do it. Right? If I preach an application, I need to practice it. And if I don't, there's a lot of things at stake. And so all of that is in view with this message. And you'll notice I kind of left off the second half of verse 5. The second half of verse 5 actually begins the rest of his argument. And so we will pick up there next week. But the application is this: we need to take the calling of the Lord on our lives very seriously. If he's called us to lead, we need to do it well. If he's called us to follow, we need to do it well. But in everything, we need to be guarded, we need to be measured, we need to be deliberate with our actions and with our words, because faith is expressed externally. It's expressed in your works, and it's expressed in your speech. And so we will pick up there next week, and we will look at the power of the tongue, part 2, and just buckle up, it's going to get rough.